We've heard from some amazing athletes in the course of this podcast, and I've been particularly struck by people who have set superfast cycling records. If you haven't heard them, go back and listen to the likes of Jenny Graham, Jonas Deichmann, and Sean Conway. It struck me that what was missing were normal people, normal cyclists who weren't out to break speed records, but who still achieved amazing rides. So today, we meet the life cyclers, Martina Doherty and Nigel Birdsall. They cycled from their home in East London to New Zealand over the course of 2 years. Their route was designed to visit places they hadn't previously seen and took them through Scandinavia, Eastern Europe, India, Myanmar, Southeast Asia, Australia, and into New Zealand just as COVID-19 hit. They made it back home where I spoke to them, and I couldn't help but wonder how much cycling they had previously done before embarking on this huge commitment.
Yeah, we did a few smaller tours within Europe. In fact, we actually started in Japan. So we went to Japan about 10 years ago for just a holiday, and we ended up deciding to do a week of cycling around the southern island. With a guy that basically guided us around. And then when we came back to Europe, we thought, well, we can probably do that ourselves. So we had a go at doing a few smaller tours around Europe and basically just took a bike and a backpack, and that was it. But for no more than about 10 days at a time. So to suddenly decide that we were going to go a little bit further was a bit of a big step for us.
And to actually add to that, we didn't even take our own bikes. We used to go to Europe, hire a bike, and just make do with what we had. So it was very, very much just get out on a bike and enjoy the great outdoors.
So it was sort of, I don't know, we had had a little taster of it. And I think that in the annals of history, I'd always envisaged that I would have a van and drive around Europe with a kayak and a bike in the back of it and go exploring for, you know, 6 months at a time, maybe. But one night we decided that we were having a chat over a couple of beers, and wouldn't it be good if we went for a cycle around Europe instead? And that sounded like a great idea. And then a little bit later on in the evening, after we had maybe had another couple of beers, we said, let's cycle to New Zealand. And the sort of idea stuck. And I think it was the next morning afterwards that we sort of said, well, actually, that does sound like quite a good idea, but it's going to take a bit of time. So we then went into a kind of saving mode and trying to maybe understand a little bit more of what other people had done. So we read a few books, but I didn't want to take too much of what they had done. It was our journey. We had to make it up as we went along. We wanted to make it ours, but you can always glean tips off other people's stuff. So that's basically how it all started.
But you weren't trying to set any kind of record here, were you, Martina? I mean, I was interested in the way your route seemed to take you on a bit of a loop up into Scandinavia, and then that picked your way down. It was kind of an interesting route that you picked. Had you predetermined what that was going to be? And could you just talk me through it a little bit? What was the goal when you set off? What was the direction of travel, and did you stick to it?
Yeah, well, I suppose before we even set off, our goal was to discover the world from the back of a bike. It wasn't really to put in miles and just cycle. So that helped us decide on the route and, you know, oh, we've never been to Scandinavia. Let's, you know, go that way. We're not in a rush, other than we gave ourselves a 2-year time limit. And we had originally decided We thought we could get a ferry from the UK straight to Norway. As it turns out, we couldn't do that. So that's why we crossed into Holland and then went up Germany, Denmark and Scandinavia. And purely it was because neither of us had been there. And then we could have taken the more, I guess, you know, the easier route, I guess, or the more popular, you know, France, more well-known countries, but again, it was that thing
in a way the psychologically safer route would have been what you're suggesting, to come down through France, Germany, all those countries where we've got an idea of the Romance languages, we can speak their languages. But because you'd been to Sweden, you didn't.
Yeah, exactly. And it was that, again, we'd never been to Eastern Europe, and you know, we're doing this to push our boundaries, to learn more about the world. And we had already cycled in France, and I lived in Germany for a while. And, you know, it really was, let's do something different and go to different places. And so we had that rough route planned. And then we, you know, that was before we left. And then as we went along, it was like, yeah, this is going well, so we'll stick to it.
Were you just leisure cyclists, Nigel?
Do you know what? I used to commute back and forth to work each day, but
how far is that?
It was probably about 10 miles in each direction at the most. So, and at the weekends, no, not really, to be honest. We were literally holiday cyclists in that, you know, once or twice a year we would fly somewhere, jump on a bike just with a small backpack and cycle. And then, you know, so we weren't huge cyclists at all.
So you weren't intimidated by the act of being on a bike for that long? You weren't worried about injury? You weren't worried about fitness, about how long you could sustain the distance of mileages and all that kind of thing?
Yes, I think. and to be honest, do you know what? A lot of people sort of say you get bike fit, and I would absolutely agree with that. And actually going up through the lowland countries of Northern Europe before we got to Scandinavia was actually a real blessing in disguise. Because had we just gone straight from the UK to Norway, we would have been in shock, because there are some serious hills there. Whereas actually we battled across some windy plains of Northern Europe, which built up our bike fitness. And actually throughout the whole of our trip, I'd say that our fitness went up and down, depending on what the terrain had been like. And I think we learned probably about middle of Eastern Europe that we had to look in advance as to what the terrain was going to be like over the next sort of few weeks, so that we could say, do you know what, it's going to get really hilly soon. We need to rein back how far we're going each day, or else it, over a sustained period of time, it absolutely tires you out. And I think that actually one of the things that people don't really mention when you read about cycling long distances is the mental strain on you. You're forever planning, finding out where you want to go, how long it's going to take, where you're going to stay, where the food is, etc., etc. And, you know, on more than one occasion, we sort of conked out mentally and physically. And we said, right, we need to, you know, rein it back here and put roots down for a few days just to recover.
That's interesting. Tell me a little bit more about that, that mental strain. I do know what you talk about, because I've done a long walk, and it was a very similar kind of thing, because the navigation and the planning and the water supply and everything fell to me. But I imagine when it's a pair of you, does one take the lead on that? How did you work it between the two of you?
Yeah, we sort of fell into different roles. Nigel did take on the navigation part of it, and that was probably a good thing, because when I left, I could barely follow a blue dot on Google Maps. and you know, I fell into the role of keeping an eye on our food supplies and knowing what we needed to top up. We both looked at sort of ideas for accommodation. We fell into natural roles. And there really was, you never, even on a day off, you never really had a day off, because you were always thinking a day ahead or a couple of days ahead. When we leave here, you know, what's available in terms of accommodation? How much food do we need to have? How's our water? You always had to preempt scenarios and be prepared. So, and on our days off, then at the start, we often did far too much. We thought, oh yeah, we're here, you know, let's go and see this and let's climb here and, you know, go for a hike or something. And we, towards the end of the trip, it really was, we would pick places to have a day off where there really was nothing to do, so that is all we would do, is actually just rest up and relax.
Because there's laundry and there's the food shopping and all this kind of stuff that people don't think about. Because when you're out for a long time, things get really dirty and fall apart. There's maintenance, isn't there?
Yeah, and to be honest, we still get excited when we see a washing machine.
A laundromat.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. But the whole planning thing that goes on in your head the whole time is not just on a single day-to-day process. In my head, it was always, what are we doing today, tomorrow, and the next day? And then it'd be, what are we doing in 2 to 3 weeks' time? And then what are we doing in 2 to 3 months' time?
It doesn't sound very enjoyable, Nigel.
It is. You've got plenty of time to think about it on a bike. although we had some main destinations in mind as we were going from country to country, whilst in each of the individual countries, we were definitely just meandering. So if somebody, some local had sort of like said, you must go to this place, or this place is very beautiful and not many tourists go there, or some particular site that they think that we shouldn't miss, we'd go and have a look at the map and go, do you know what, you know, we can go over there and we can go and see it. So we did have quite a lot of flexibility, but you just had to keep an eye on the timelines. I think in Europe it was particularly easy because we were there for about 8-9 months, and so we weren't under particularly any time constraints. When we got further afield where there were visas involved, you then are very much under a single deadline.
Let's just break your journey up, I think, as you did on your blog. There's the European leg, you've got India, and then there's Southeast Asia leading you on to New Zealand. And I don't think it's a spoiler alert to say you actually made it all the way. So let's just talk about the Europe bit first. What was for you the highlight of Europe, considering you're not doing that safe route we discussed earlier through the France, Germany, Italy access? What was the best bit of Eastern Europe? Or what are the, at least not the best bit, but what are the memories that stick in your mind when you think back to that section of your ride?
I think Eastern Europe for us was a real eye-opener, and so much more pleasant and beautiful and really nice people that we hadn't expected. And I say we hadn't expected, I think it was more just from our lack of education, lack of experience in being in Eastern Europe. We had our first warm showers experience there, and
staying with someone when you say warm showers.
So
that you better explain that for someone who doesn't know the warm showers website.
Sure, it's a concept of couch surfing for cyclists, where other cycling lovers or ex cyclists open up their house or garden, or they offer some kind of hospitality, and it really is down to them. But you get in touch, they respond and say, yeah, you can come and stay. And more often than not, you know, they cook you an evening meal and welcome you into their home. And we had our first experience there with a couple, Jan and Evett, and their very young family in Slovakia. And that was just, it completely blew us away, because they were, you know, and we didn't realize it at the time, but they had a small two bedroom flat. They gave us their own bedroom. And we only found out the second day that we were there that she was actually pregnant at the time. So that amazing generosity was just fantastic. And we had initially planned to stay 2 days, and they were going to go away for the third day. And they said their plans changed, but they were actually willing to leave us their house and the keys, and just that level of trust. So I think for Europe, it was just that sort of set the tone for the hospitality and just the amazing generosity of the people all throughout Eastern Europe.
I think it's often the people, isn't it, that makes a difference. A lot of people, when they do a long trip, come back and say, you know what, I was expecting it was the sights, the being out there in my own mind, it's the people.
Oh, definitely. For us throughout the world, it has been the people that have just touched our hearts and, yeah, created the best memories for us.
I think what's interesting about Eastern Europe is the sort of bad impression that there is of it in the UK as a whole. Now, I'm speaking from a personal point of view. I'm sure that there's some people that have been to Eastern Europe before we have, and they find that it's a fantastic place like we did. But time and again, I felt a little bit embarrassed that, you know, we had this perception of they're all a bunch of bandits, gypsies and thieves, and you know, it's none of the kind, and these countries are out there to be explored, because you know, tourism is still, you know, quite in its infancy there. And that's the great thing about it, is that on a bike, because you can only do say 100 kilometers a day, you have to stop at all these very small places, and quite often the people will look at you and say, sorry, why are you here? And that's the great thing about it. You're in a place where, you know, they haven't seen normally a Westerner, let alone somebody on a bicycle.
Were you always staying in accommodation, or did you have a tent or any form of sort of shelter yourselves?
We have a tent, and I would say we mixed it between camping on normal campsites, a bit of wild camping, but we also use hostels and what are called agritourism sites, so basically staying on farms. And when we would get to a larger place where we wanted to stay for a few days, a tent is very difficult to stay in when you want to stay inside a town or a city. You attract attention. So what we would do is we would get an Airbnb or something like that, which gave us the freedom to actually decamp properly.
And wash our clothes.
Yeah, wash our clothes and air the tent out and things like that. So it was a mix of all, to be honest.
And you were using panniers, weren't you? You weren't going for one of these lightweight bike packing rigs where everything's in line and strapped to the frame?
Yes, that's correct. Well, we went for 2 years. I know that there's a lot of people that go very minimal, and all power to them. But because we were going for 2 years, you know, there's a lot of stuff to carry. I would say that we carried just about the exact right amount, and that was absolutely by luck and judgment. We didn't throw very much stuff away. We used everything that we had, all bar a few pieces of first aid kit, which you don't want to use unless you have to, and some repair stuff for the bikes. So actually, all in all, we took about the right amount of stuff.
Yeah.
And you picked Shand bicycles, and it was your blog on there that actually I found you through, actually. I thought it was really interesting. Why did you go for steel?
Do you know what? Purely for the fact that I thought that if something did break on it, I could take it somewhere quite easily and it should be able to get fixed, whether that be in a bike shop or in a mechanic's garage somewhere along the line.
Aluminium, the welder somewhere could put it back together again.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. When it comes to things like carbon fiber, yes, you can fix it, but it takes a bit of a specialist. And the same for titanium and even aluminium. I would say that steel is the easiest one to fix. But as it was, the bikes were fantastic. We didn't really have any major problems with them.
Any specific sort of saddles or any advice for picking a bike while we're just talking bikey things that you found worked well? I mean, how long did it take you to get comfy on your saddle? I'm sure my wife would want me to ask that question of both of you.
I suppose the short answer is we never really got comfortable on our saddles. we went through different phases of, you know, hurting, and both of us seemed to hurt at different times. And I think that's just the nature of the beast, really. You're on a bike for 6-7 hours every day. We have Brooks saddles, but they are quite hard. There are other ones we've seen that definitely seem a lot softer, but I think it's probably a trial and error thing with saddles, to be honest.
One of the problems that we did have is that, especially in the hotter climates, is that we get a lot rid of a lot of salt, so we get salt sores. So we're forever washing all of our clothes. But even with that, within an hour of getting on the bike in Southeast Asia, where you sweat a lot, it's 90% humidity at 7 o'clock in the morning. You can't help but get these very annoying salt sores, no matter how much you clean yourself and clean your clothing.
So are you using normal cycling shorts? Because this is coming back to me, actually. I remember in a desert, hiking in a desert, I was sweating so much. I was just wearing normal underwear and really lightweight trousers. The nearest town I had to go into and buy nappy rash cream. Clearly, you can work out the details. And there's the thing. Are you wearing cycling shorts for all of this?
We did, yes.
And they weren't too tight. And you know, you've got to clean. You've got to stay on top of cleaning them. Sorry, I'm getting really too nitty gritty here, aren't I?
No. That's like it, we would rinse them out just in normal water, and you know, they'd be dry. So every night, obviously, when we get somewhere where we did have laundry facilities, we wash them properly. But just to get rid of the salt, we would wash them all the time. And even then, I mean, without getting into too much detail, but in India, Nigel had a really bad infection and he had to get antibiotics because one of his sores became infected. So, yes, it wasn't, we didn't get it. It's not that we didn't get off lightly, but it just didn't become a major issue in that we expected it to happen.
Yeah.
And we were prepared as well we could, you know, the same as you. We had plenty of creams and all that stuff. But to be honest, that's there's only so much you can.
Well, exactly. To be honest, we did find one product, and I don't know if we should name names or anything.
Go
like
on,
that,
name but, it, name it.
But it's actually this was suggested by another cyclist as well, and it's by Elizabeth Arden, and it's an 8-hour cream or something like that.
But costs a fortune.
It costs an absolute fortune, but you only need to use a little tiny, literally a smearing of it. Sorry, that's going to hit a little bit deep, yeah. Isn't it?
But it did work.
Elizabeth Arden, eight hour cream because yeah. You're worth it. or whatever the catchline is. Okay, we've talked about going to India. Let's move on a little bit out of Europe. Is India as chaotic as everyone says, and how are you greeted when you rock up on a bike?
Yes, it is absolutely chaotic in terms of the traffic. I mean, anything goes on the roads, from, you know, cows just wandering aimlessly on an 18-lane motorway to guys pushing, you know, little trucks that just stop at the side of the road and everybody offloads on a bus. Traffic coming down the road towards you in the wrong direction. But it is amazing how quickly you adjust and get used to that. You know, you just have to learn to be very aware and very alert all the time, and that in itself is exhausting. And then the people, that was intense. We were definitely a novelty, like, you know, as Nigel said earlier, a lot of the places that we go through are not tourist destinations, so you're stopping in a small little village. The majority of people there may never have seen a white Westerner, never mind two on, you know, strange looking bikes, and you would automatically draw a crowd, and in a curious way, but sometimes it could be quite intimidating, and it definitely was very intense, very exhausting. And the 3.5 months there, we were glad to leave, but now that we've had time to process it a bit better, it was a brilliant experience. But it was just, you know, there was, I mean, 50 times a day we'd get stopped, either people on mopeds or bikes or just walking, stopping, you know, selfie, 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 absolutely obsessed with having selfies with us. And at the start we were, you know, very obliging. At the end it was, you know, no thank you. So very, very intense. But we did have good experiences there as well. And I'll let Nigel.
So there's... a very much a class divide in India, in that there's a very small proportion of people that are educated at the top of the tree, and then the other 1.2 billion people are even what the Indians call the uneducated masses. It's not a very nice term, but those people are the ones that we were interacting with most of the time, and they just don't know how to react to us. So their default is to laugh and point at you, which for us is... it almost feels like it's being rude, but you do adapt to it, but it takes a bit of time. I think it took us a good couple of weeks to even work out that every time we go to a restaurant at the side of the road to eat or some accommodation, that the reaction that we were getting was not what we would get back at home or anywhere else in Europe for that matter. Their hospitality seemed like it, or the people involved in it seemed to be almost rude to us, but actually it's just that they can't comprehend what we were doing. And we did actually have some people say, I've never seen a white Westerner before. Can I take your picture? So that we were definitely in places where, well, to be honest, even in some of the more tourist areas, we went to the Taj Mahal. I don't think you can miss it if you're up near Delhi. It's one of the must-see kind of places. But even there, we were very much in a minority and people still wanted to have their photo taken with us. And that was sort of our first taste of what was going to happen when we finally got on our bikes. Did we ever get used to it? Not really. They tend to invade your space a little bit as well, which is a very un-Western thing to do. But it sounds like it was all doom and gloom, but it wasn't at all. It was just a very, very different experience from perhaps what we'd expected. We'd even been told by one other cyclist that some of his friends that had been to India on bikes had to cut short their time there because they couldn't stand the intensity of the people. And that's probably a really good way of describing them. They are very, very intense people when they're interested in something that they've never seen before.
I can imagine it is overpowering. I don't think you're doing them a disservice. I think you're actually painting a fair picture. I'm just, how did you work out what route you were going to take through India? Because you were heading, and this surprised me actually, you were heading to Burma and you made it all the way across. What decided your route?
That's a very good question. And do you know what? I'm not absolutely certain. I know what the answer is. We said that we were going to try and visit some friends down in Pune. So we started cycling south, and I think we were going to decide en route as to how far we thought we were going to get. So I suppose our original destination was to do sort of the touristy stuff up in the near Jaipur and Jodhpur. And then we would carry on south and see what happened. And as it was, we did get all the way down to Mumbai. We went through Pune, and then we found that we could actually go a little bit further. We didn't quite make it to Goa. We were maybe about 100 kilometers north of that before we decided that we'd have to cut across. And actually, even the Indians said, why don't you just get on a train and take a train right the way across India? Because there's nothing in the bits in the middle worth seeing. And actually, we cycled the whole way. And the bits that were in the middle were where we had some of our best interactions with people. So we got onto the warm showers hosting again, and we ended up having some fantastic interactions with people right the way through the central part of India.
Goodness, there are people there who will host you in their homes.
Yes, absolutely. And on couch surfing as well. So we stayed with two sisters. They taught us things like how to make Indian food and chapatis and things like that. We stayed with some school teachers in central India. We went round a massive Sikh temple in the central part of India. And we also, through all those contacts, we actually ended up staying with some tribals up in the hills, again, sort of in the central part of India. So all these hostings, sometimes it's not necessarily just the host that will host you, but it's also their friends, and they pass you on to the next person, which is a great way of delving a little bit into their way of life rather than just the cycling.
Yeah. And then you have to tear yourself away. What was it like planning those bits? Because with that inevitable chaos that you were talking about and the stress of trying to think not one day, but 2, 3, 4 weeks ahead, did that pile up, or did there come a point where you just went through your hands and went, you know what, it'll happen?
No, I guess we always kind of had a destination in mind, you know, for a couple of weeks ahead, that although we would meander, I mean, one of the things we wanted to do was, as a treat for ourselves, was to see tigers in the wild if we could. So, you know, do a safari in India. So that was, so things like that, that would have to be booked in advance. Then that gave us, a definitive date. We need to be somewhere. Yes. So that dictated then, for example, when we didn't go to Goa, we knew, you know, that it's like, well, if we go the whole way down there, that's going to take 5 days. We're going to be rushing to get back up. So, that, you know, there was a few sort of key markers like that. And we, with India, yeah, we didn't, it was very, we had to let things just happen and not plan things too textbook-like. But you always had a fair idea of the rough direction you were heading in. Or, and also from meeting and talking to people, it was, you know, the areas to avoid. There's that thing as well of when you reach out to ask for accommodation from couch surfing or warm showers hosts, that then you've got a deadline to be somewhere as well. So although it, you know, it really was quite relaxed and it wasn't too rigidly planned, there always was a plan. And then I guess visas as well became an issue. So you were very conscious that we have to be in Calcutta area for such and such a date because we'll be crossing the border into Bangladesh.
Yeah,
this
we
is
could
what
always
I was come on to ask about. You tell me a bit about the visas, because I was wondering how much you did in advance, how much you'd prepared in advance, so you knew where you needed to be for when, even before you went home, and then once you got on the road. Let's just talk a little bit about that.
I did quite a bit of research into which countries we would need visas for, and how long each visa was going to be for, and how far in advance you have to apply for them. We did, because we live in London, it's fairly easy for us to go to the actual embassies and ask them in person. In fact, we went to the Myanmar embassy at one point just to ask whether the borders were actually open. And at that point, the guy that was there said, well, the borders unfortunately open and close quite regularly up in the areas that we were talking about. And he said, I can't tell you really. You should maybe have other plans just in case. So we did have other plans just in case. But luckily, the times that we passed through, we were lucky to get through all of the borders with no problems.
And then the result, yeah, through Nigel's research, we knew where we could do border on arrival, where we could do visa on arrival, or where we could apply for an e-visa, which, you know, you mentioned Myanmar or Burma. That was an e-visa application. The only one that we did on arrival was Bangladesh. The others were all online, and we were pretty lucky, actually. We'd heard stories of people, you know, of bribery and having difficulties crossing borders or having problems even with their visas. We didn't have any issues at all, and all of our crossings were pretty straightforward and hassle-free, which were, you know, very lucky.
Even going into Laos, which is renowned for being pretty corrupt, to going across the border, we were really lucky. We submitted our visa application and it was fine. But even getting across the bridge, which goes across the Mekong, we've been told numerous blogs and what have you, that there's normally a bunch of tuk-tuk drivers there that will insist that they escort you across the bridge because you're not allowed to cycle it. And that they will demand a certain fee. It's all just a scam. But as it was, we got there so early in the morning that even the tuk-tuk drivers weren't awake. So we just cycled straight across the bridge and out the other side and went, did that really just happen? Yes, she keep going.
I'm interested in your Southeast Asia side of things. But just tell me a little bit about Myanmar. What was that like to cycle through? Because I don't think I've spoken to anybody who's done that.
Yeah, that was, before when we started off, we weren't really sure if Myanmar fell into the subcontinent or if it fell into Southeast Asia. If we're absolutely honest, we had no idea what to expect in terms of culture, and the people. And from the start, it was just amazing. It was such a shame. It was such a change because we crossed from India, the northeastern pocket of India into Myanmar, and it was far more developed and westernized than we had expected. What really shocked us was the day that, so the border crossing, the roads were so bad that we knew that it would be pretty impossible to cycle it, so we had booked a maxi taxi that could take our bikes. So we booked that with the help of the person we stayed with on the Indian side of the border. And so we arrived in Myanmar, bikes intact, and we, you know, there's no way, when we saw the road, it was absolutely horrendous. We couldn't have done that. But when we got there, it was, everywhere was selling beer, which we were quite shocked at. We expected quite an oppressed, quite sad, defeated type race of people. They were just so lovely. Even talking about them now just gives me tingles, because they were so excited to see us. They were just really happy, nice people. And we were so the thing about Myanmar is that you have to, as foreigners, you have to stay in certain hotels that not everywhere can keep a foreigner. So there's certain ones that you have to check that they're registered to accept foreigners. But then when you get there, I mean, the standard was just amazing. So we'd gone from India and Bangladesh and then back into India again. and then straight into like lovely, crisp, clean, white sheets, air-conditioned rooms, beer. I mean, it was just...
And are you paying a fortune for this?
No, a tenner for the two of us for an air-conditioned room a night. I mean, that was, you know, the average. So it was pretty... It was just so unexpected and so unlike anything we had in, you know, we'd... any ideas we'd had in our heads beforehand. So it was amazing. We were there though in the hot season, so there was a couple of days it hit 48 degrees and it was just so I mean you'd be sweating from the minute you would get up. By the time you'd have the bike packed, it would
ride in that, could you?
That was our hottest, and so we started getting up at 4 a.m. when we were there, so our whole day shifted forwards. We'd get up at 4, we'd be on the road at first light, which was amazing in its own way because we saw so many wonderful sunrises. And then we would get to destination by midday at the latest, and then we would do what the locals did and then just go for an afternoon nap. And, you know, we were lucky enough to be able to afford air conditioning because a lot of them, you know, the locals couldn't. And interestingly, one of the things I do remember most from Myanmar was that they had power cuts 2, 3, 4 times a day, every day. So even though you had an air conditioned room, you would, you know, be like, yay, you know, nice and cool. And then it's like you had to avail of that before it would cut out maybe for 2 or 3 hours. But
You're having to wear different clothes in this kind of heat because it's going to be, you can't be wearing the same clothes you're cycling through Scandinavia in. I mean, you're changing your kit, long sleeves and what have you. You're wearing helmets, big floppy hats. What are you wearing?
Yeah, no, we wore the same pretty much, if we're honest. I mean, we wore helmets, we wore bike shorts, because I think no matter what you were never going to be cool. And I know Lycra is sweaty anyway. So the only difference was we were wearing sleeveless, I was wearing sleeveless tops, but we still had our gilets on. So you would still, you know, from a safety perspective. So it really, our attire wasn't that much different. It just, well, you absolutely had to be meticulous about rinsing it out every night because, yeah, you're absolutely saturated. But
you've mentioned safety there. Nigel, how did you feel about safety on the roads throughout the whole of your trip?
Do you know what? I think that if I look back at it, I think we must have been slightly mad at times. We definitely had a couple of occasions where we were not particularly comfortable. Cycling to Istanbul is written in the annals of numerous people's blogs and what have you about how uncomfortable it is cycling into Istanbul. It absolutely threw it down with rain for a starter. The cars are just mad. And we spent about a day and a half cycling into the city. And in fact, all cities are really quite hard to cycle into. There's a slow bit on the outside. There's a fast bit as you get into the center of the town. And then it goes very slow again once you get right into the center. And I think that goes for just about most cities. So every time we were coming to a large city, another good example would be Mumbai. There was a nice gentle bit on the outside. Then there was a crazy bit sort of coming into the center. And then the center got very quiet when everything slowed down. And, you know, sometimes it wasn't a fun day out. But actually, I mean, I got knocked off a couple of times in India, but it all happened in slow motion. So the panniers actually worked quite well. It's a bit like an airbag in a car. They stop you fall. But in Vietnam, Martina fell off her bike and actually knocked herself out. And that was without any traffic helping her. She just hit a piece of gravel going down a hill. And so we had to spend 10 days in convalescence waiting for her to recover. But apart from that, that's a reason for wearing a helmet. It broke her helmet. So if there's anything I'll take let anybody to take away from this is wear a helmet the whole time.
Are are you using clip-in pedals?
I think we were clipped in at that time, were we?
No, we were clipped in Europe. And then when it got really hot in Asia, that was the only clothing item that really changed. We wore sandals.
Yeah. Right. So we've got pedals. So we have pedals with flats on one side and clips on the other.
Right.
And when we finished in Southeast Asia, we actually went back to clips again because we both prefer it. But when it got really hot and humid, putting your feet inside cycling Socks. Shoes every day is not very pleasant.
Let's talk about that big loop you did in Southeast Asia. You seem to be trying to avoid northern Thailand or maybe to visit some more countries. What was going on there? Were you just trying to, you know, get some more passport stamps or something?
No, not really. To be honest, out of all of those countries, Martina had only been to Thailand. So all of this was really new to us. So right the way from India onwards, we hadn't been to any of these countries, really. So, yes, I suppose we were trying to see as many different countries as possible. But it was just a case of what would be a nice route. And actually, at one point when we were in Laos, we were sort of planning on going directly west into Vietnam, because the train up to the north looked really hard. But then we met another cyclist coming in the opposite direction who actually said, do you know what, if I can do it, anyone can do it, kind of thing. She had not been on the road that long, and she said, look, I'm not that fit. You guys will be fine. You've been on the road for much longer. So we took her advice and we went up through the northern part of Laos and then into the northern part of Vietnam. And do you know what? It's one of the parts that I wouldn't miss. It's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, it's tough cycling, but it's almost untouched by tourism. So you get, in some very remote areas. It's and it's beautiful. So, you know, I would thoroughly recommend that area.
Are there any cyclists out there?
Do you know what? That's a very strange thing that we thought that we were going to see a lot more than we did. In Europe, I think we probably saw, apart from on the Danube, where there is just hundreds of cyclists, everywhere else, I think we probably could count on one hand how many people we saw doing long distance cycling in Europe. In India, I think we saw one. We saw one other.
Yes.
Then in Southeast Asia, I think we probably saw a dozen at the most. And then when we got to Australia, we saw quite a few more. And then in New Zealand, there's hundreds of them. They're everywhere. Hmm.
But you made it there anyway, at least. You got all the way to New Zealand and really only just got there in time with all this COVID stuff going on.
Yeah, I mean, we only had to cut our trip short by 2 weeks, which, you know, it's an absolute miracle, really, that we had originally planned to set out in April 2020. So had we done that, we would still be here and we never would have done it.
Yeah.
So to actually get the trip that we had to and only have to cut it short by 2 weeks. I mean, the thing that we missed out, there's two things we missed out on, really, was kind of having a kickback and a bit of a hurrah in Auckland, knowing it was all over and having time to process, you know, our brilliant trip. And also Nigel had an ex-colleague that he wanted to catch up with who's north of Auckland, and he hadn't seen him for 25 years. So they were the two things that we missed out on by having to take the come home earlier than planned. But in the grand scheme of things, it really, really wasn't bad. And we got to see, even in New Zealand, everything that we wanted to see. So
I'm interested, I'm not going to ask you how much it cost you to do this, but if someone was going to plan to do something like this, what kind of budget do you think you need to go into it with?
Do you know what? I think that depends on what kind of trip that the person wants to go on.
Well, a bit like yours, if you know you're going to do a little bit of a mixture of tents, but you know that in cities and every few days you're going to want to have some accommodation, apart from anything else, you're going to want to get yourself and your kit clean.
Yeah, so Northern Europe is expensive. You know, you're spending minimum 25 euros a day. And then the further south and east you go, then it's going to get cheaper. You know, we were getting accommodation in southeast Europe for sort of 10 euros a day, and then the food on top of that. Whereas Southeast Asia is unbelievably cheap. You know, we were living on maybe,
oh God, a couple of quid a day.
Yeah, literally £2 or £3 per person per day for food, and then a fiver for accommodation, and that's good accommodation as well. Yes, you could make it cheaper if you want to by using a tent, but if you want to try and sleep in 35 degrees and 95% humidity, then by all means do. It's much nicer to spend £5 on an air-conditioned room. You also get to interact with people a bit more. Australia and New Zealand are expensive as well. It depends on where you go. There's a lot. There is quite a few cyclists in Southeast Asia, and I think they mainly go there because it's generally cheap and you can stay there for a long time.
You've got to hope that that's not the last year that this sort of journey has been possible with all this virus.
Yeah,
I agree. I hope that the borders open soon. You know, we're already planning our next trips, so we are hopeful that.
Ooh, where would they go? Where are they to?
So Martina's from Northwest Ireland, and we're planning to cycle from London back to her home and then around Ireland and back again. But we're also hopefully planning a South America trip as well. So for maybe 6 to 8 months in South America. And actually, even on our trip that we've just been on, we were earmarking a whole bunch of places that we didn't really get enough time to either look around or we didn't get a chance to visit at all. So the Asian side of Turkey is a really good example of that. We only got as far as Istanbul before we flew to Delhi.
How are you managing to make this work and actually have and get some work on in between things? Have you kind of like become part-time workers and full-time cyclists now?
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's how I'd describe it, but I suppose it does change your outlook on life and what's important and I guess what, you know, what you want out of life. And it definitely has made us realise we can live in a lot less and we don't have to, I guess, you know, work all the time to actually have a good life. So our plan is to do some project work, you know, work for a little bit and then do cycling trips and fund it that way, that kind of get the best of both worlds. I still, you know, want to be mentally stimulated by work, so I definitely do want to keep working, but not just working and then counting down until you get your 2 weeks holidays or your 3 weeks holidays. So it is about balancing it.
We also found that we can leave all of our stuff behind. We did a very good job before we left for 2 years of basically getting rid of everything that we, all of our furniture, basically, and as much of everything else that we could think of to just get rid of it. So we're almost starting from scratch again. But this time round, we're not going to buy very much because we know that we're going to be off again. So we're going to lead a pretty minimal life here so that we can just save for the next trip.
When you look back on this whole journey, what ideas, what memories, what thoughts bubble to the surface and feature prominently and that you'll be thinking about for a long time to come?
Well, I think that for both of us, it's very much the people that we met. And we do have a couple of stories that sort of highlight exactly what I mean here. And the first was when we were crossing from the very eastern part of India into Myanmar. And we had just been through Bangladesh and then eastern India. And it had taken us about 6 or 7 weeks. We spent time in a town in eastern India called Aizawl. And we found out in Aizawl, it was Easter 2019. And we found out in Aizawl that the state of Mizoram had just gone dry, so there was no alcohol. And we were actually staying there for about 5 days. And it would have been the first time that we could have had a beer for something like 6 or 7 weeks. And we were a little bit disappointed, but we hung around there because it was Easter and it's a very Christian area and everything closes down. And then we continued our journey on right to the border with Myanmar. And we stayed in a government rest house there with the owner, whose name is Remy. And she looked after us and she said, did we want to have dinner? And we said, yes, we've got enough rupees left for our dinner. And she said, OK, well, I'll go and get the provisions for it. So off she went. And when she came back, she said, actually, whilst you're in Zokatar, which is the name of the town, she said, you have to go and register with the local police. And we said, OK, well, what do we do then? She said, well, grab your passports and I'll take you to see Robert. He's the chief of police. So we went to see Robert and he was sat there not looking very much like a policeman in that he had a vest and a pair of shorts on. And that was it. And he took our passports and had a look through them, looked at their visas and what have you. And then he started asking us about our journey. And it was he had good enough English and Remy had perfect English. And we were having this very, very cool conversation. When Robert, who is the chief of police, turned around and said, would we like a drink? And we said, yes, thinking it would be either a soft drink or a chai tea or something like that. And he said, did we like beer? And so knowing full well that that Mizoram is now a dry
state. You're thinking this is a trap.
Is this a trap? So when we said yes, as I was putting my hand out to accept the beer, I was almost expecting the handcuffs to come on. But he seemed fine with it. And actually, I'd sort of earlier on, I thought that he smelt a little bit of alcohol. Even when we were talking, I thought, no, that can't be right. So we sat and Remy had a beer as well, which is very unusual in India for women to drink. But anyway, the four of us had this really nice conversation when Robert then said to him, do we like rice wine? And he said, what sort of like sake? And he said, yes, I have some that I'm brewing in my fridge. So he then goes and gets this sake, which is basically in a pot in his fridge. It's rice with some yeast added, and he pours it out. So it was a very cool situation to be sat in with the chief of police drinking his own illegal hooch.
Nigel Birdsall and Martina Doherty with just one of the memories from a two-year trip squeezed into less than an hour. They don't do Twitter or Instagram, but you can read about their trip and see their photos at thelifecyclers.com. There's a link in the show notes along with information about how you can support these podcasts with a small micropayment. I'm Simon Willis. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.